Hey, and thanks for listening. This is Conversations, the True Voice Media podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard. Let's get started. This is episode 21 of True Voice Media Conversations. It's our podcast, and today I have Holly Isdale, who is joining us on this episode. Holly, tell us about yourself.
Hi, Jeff. I am a consultant, reformed financial Wall Street person, and now I tend to help families and individuals with financial matters and trying to get things organized. Bringing peace of mind to clients is often the easiest way to think about it. Although I had one client that said, you just help people get stuff done.
So for any of the people that are listening and they're used to hearing me have, tech people on and social media heads and people that are, you know, managing marketing budgets for companies and things like that, they may be wondering, you know, why do I have this consultant?
Why the heck do you have this estate planner on the phone?
Why is she here? Well, for those listening, here's why. Because we're about to have one of the most, I think, interesting conversations that has taken place on this podcast, because we're going to talk about one of your areas of interest that, you know, from the very first time that we talked about it, I was just totally hooked on the concept and so interested to hear your perspective and kind of get into it. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what we're calling digital death. Sound good?
Sounds awesome.
Sounds morbid, but I think it's more interesting than morbid.
It does, but it's kind of cool.
Yeah, so let's start out this way. Why don't you tell everybody listening kind of a general overview of what digital death is, what you see about it, why you're interested in it. Kind of give us the lay of the land.
Sure. So I think I often will start discussions this way. If you had died last night, not tonight because I'm superstitious, but if you had died last night, would the people that you cared about, would your partners, would your significant others, would your clients know how to access your information? Would they know what you think is valuable? Would they know what you think is important? And I do a lot of estate planning work. I do a lot of financial planning for families. And so a lot of the discussions that I have are on people's legacies. And, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, it was easy. Your legacy was something we wrote down on a book. We had letters. If I needed to find your financial information, it was in a file cabinet. And if you were really disorganized, we just sat by the mailbox and we waited for the checks to come in or the bank statements to come in, and we would be able to find your life. When you look at it today, I can't even say, well, just go look on my computer, because half of the stuff isn't even on my computer. It might be on my iPad. It might be on my phone. It might reside somewhere in the cloud on a thing that I know, but it's not even bookmarked. And so even finding the assets are hard. Accessing them is harder because, you know, you don't have my passwords. Passwords change all the time. You might have a password keeper, but I'd have to know about it. And then all of the traditional issues of how we value assets. So I think, you know, the fundamental issue that I have is this is an area that I stumbled into from a legal perspective and looked around expecting that someone had thought about it, certainly the people who deal with tech all the time, and no one had. And in fact, all of our laws are geared around protecting privacy, not providing access. And access and transfer of assets and preservation of assets is really what is important from a legal perspective. So, again, for me, the fundamental issue is no one's really thinking about this, and yet our lives have changed so substantially in the last decade to move everything into technology. And we're creating so much content every day that we're going to be overwhelmed with having to even keep up with it if we stopped today and just started to get organized, much less if we wait until the millennials are starting to die off and have to deal with this.
Yeah. I mean, if you remember when the Heartbleed bug came out, where everybody was, you know, you had to change your password on like 800 different sites. I came to the conclusion that we had reached a breaking point already in complexity where I didn't even know all of the sites that I was probably using. And I use a password keeper, and to even track down all the different places where I probably have a password, or maybe I have an old site or something, and there may be remnants of digital data and leftovers that I've put around the web, I couldn't even fathom that. So I'm thinking moving, and I'm pretty organized and I use a password keeper. I'm thinking, you know, I'm imagining people who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and just the amount of sites that they have. And then this this onslaught, as you mentioned, of millennials who are tapped in and using so many sites, some of which they just abandon and just move on. How do we keep track of all of that? And you raise some really interesting points about how do we value all of that, because this is an entirely different space. But to your point, what I think is really interesting, sorry to cut you off, but I looked online because I remember you said not many people are talking about this. I was like, that can't be true. I mean, this is, you know, everybody lives and everybody dies. Like that's par for the course. Everybody's going to eat food. Everybody's going to go to sleep, pay taxes and die, right? We all do those things.
Yeah, life is 100% fatal. Very few people get off the planet alive.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. So because of that, I would think because, you know, there are restaurants to provide food for people because we all got to eat. And we're all going to die, so there's plenty of funeral homes and things. But when I did a search for digital death and I started looking for this concept around the web, I found pretty much like one or two names that were involved in this world. And then it seemed like there was just, pardon the pun, but dead space. There was nothing there. So why do you think that is, that we have this unbelievable birth of technology and movement towards the cloud and use of mobile devices and unprecedented data creation, and yet in spite of all of that, all of these assets that are going to be left behind by all of us, there are very few people talking about what to do with it. Why is that?
I think it's sort of twofold. I think, one, you've got a real disparity between the lawyers who are involved in technology issues and social media and digital privacy and the lawyers who do sort of the planning and end-of-life issues. I think also people don't tend to think about when they die until they're there. And then the lawyers who are in the space are often thinking about, you know, well, you need these six documents, and I do this as well. You know, you need these six documents. Let's think about the taxes. Let's think about all the other stuff. And yet when, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years, and when you work with families, they don't get upset. I mean, they do get upset about the investment portfolio. They get upset about who got what. But what really divides families is who ended up with a pepper shaker, you know, the salt shaker or the rug or that picture. And what people value are the feather that they picked up on a walk with their grandfather, not the stock portfolio or the check that they got. And so tangible assets are often what people look to when they say, I remember my grandfather. They don't talk about they might say, my grandfather helped me buy this house with a check or helped me buy my first car. But it's the tangible assets that we leave behind. And when I moved my parents out of their house, I brought home probably 30 moving boxes, huge. It's still taking up part of my house, of photo albums from, you know, my grandparents and, you know, probably my great-grandparents and slides and things like that. And I realized, you know, ours are all digital. Like, our tangible assets, the things that are going to mean so much to many of our family members, are online. And even if not, just reconstructing your life is going to be so hard to do if it's online. And if you're in the space and you're creating assets of value, you know, do your parents understand how to monetize it, how to talk about it? And I can guarantee you, your estate attorneys aren't saying to you, well, who should be the one in charge of your Facebook content? And is that the same person that's in charge of your business website? And these are really critical questions that people should be thinking about, in my view.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you also brought up something I think is really interesting, because you mentioned the photos. And the first thing that flashed through my head as a question is, well, what's valuable? Is it the picture or is it the image? So is it what's on the piece of paper and what's encapsulated by the, you know, the crystals and the development process? Or is it the actual physical thing itself? And as we move towards this more digital space, you know, you had mentioned the feather that you found with, you know, your grandfather as an example. And I think when we move into this world where things are more digital, and let's say I teach my son at some point, I don't have a son, but I have kids at some point, and I teach them, you know, how to manipulate PHP. You know, there's never going to be like this is that first string of code that my dad taught me to tweak. And it's just a very different world that we're moving into. And I think that makes it very challenging, because value is put into an entirely new context. You know, you mentioned a couple things about value that I think are very, very interesting, that there is – value is so relative. You know, you had said the stock portfolio versus the feather. How do you determine that, especially in your role advising a client? What's valuable? How do you assign a value to it?
Well, and you know, from a purely economic perspective, the IRS is going to come in and assign a value to something. And the IRS may look at my photo album and say, you know, my collection of digital photos that I've backed up to a peripheral hard drive is worth, you know, $18 because that's the price of the hard drive in the secondary market, totally disregarding the value of the property. When you look at photos for an art museum, for example, often what they're looking at is, you know, who developed it, when was it developed, what the paper it's on, and so forth. So if I'm buying a photograph from an art market, that's one thing. When you look at digital photography and digital assets like that that have the provenance that you have to prove that this is really a picture that was taken by the renowned photographer, and you're looking at the metadata tags. For most of us, that doesn't really matter, but it does matter when you start to think about the number of assets that we're creating today, and that we're really having a fundamental shift in the way we create assets. Because, you know, I was playing on my Kindle the other day. I was on a flight, and I just started looking at, like, all of the books that I've downloaded. And if you think about books as being $10 a piece, $9.99 on Amazon, yes, I got some for $5, I got some for $12. They don't have any value once they leave my Kindle or my iPad, because I've signed a terms of service contract and I click every time Amazon tells me to update it. I can't transfer it. Whereas if I bought those books, I would actually have something that, you know, my kids, poor things, would have to clean out when they sold the house and go, who wants all of this junk? But there's a value to those assets. And so I think, you know, value is a big issue, but also the ability to access and control the assets, because so much of what we are buying now is virtual. You know, I access a website, I access content through a website, but I don't own it. I might contribute to content, but I don't own it. And, you know, there's the tax issue of, can I monetize it versus can I access it for my kids? So I have an 18-year-old son, and he is a gamer. He's just turned 18, so in my mind, he's still like 15. But
sorry, 1998 was like 10 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly. So he, you know, he games, and we were talking about this the other night, and he was pointing out to me that, you know, you pick up this sword of something or other, and it actually has value to it. And that, you know, but the terms of Steam would prohibit you from actually using it. But, you know, the inscribed Scryox Talon can be sold for $25 in bidding on those. Well, how the heck am I ever going to find that? You know, you see pages of blog posts and Facebook pages and photos and so forth. And there are two things that really come in. There's the legal side of this, which is how do we access it? How do we prepare for it? And then there's the personal side, which is, you know, 99% of the stuff on my computer probably could get wiped because no one but me is going to care about it. But the stuff that is important needs to get flagged, and nobody's really having that discussion.
And it's constantly like an unmanageable amount. I mean, I think about just flagging photos that are important in my photo collection, and I get a little bit of anxiety thinking about it.
It's definitely, I mean, talking about death anyway is anxiety producing. There's all sorts of studies on that. And so we're supposed to explain how great you are at things so that you get confident about talking about death. But you're right. You know, going through your own photo albums, going through your closets, going through stuff, there's a process that people need to engage in to make it manageable, because if you don't start managing your photos today, you will, and your digital content, it's just completely overwhelming. I mean, if you, and for some times when I'll talk to clients about it, I just say, look, we can go back a year or two, but frankly, let's just start from today. Let's just try and figure out what websites you're on. let's try and figure out where you have content that you care about, and let's make sure it's something that's sustainable. And I've had a number of people that say, well, I backed it all up to the cloud, but we're not sure if the cloud service they chose is going to be around in X number of years.
Wow. I have like a bazillion different thoughts going on, but I want to start with this one. You know, you'd mentioned throwing things away on your computer, or throwing away and wiping away digital assets. So a couple points about that. You know, I have heard numerous stories from people my parents' age who have talked about the Mickey Mantle baseball card that their parents just threw out because it was just, they're just cards. And now, you know, they're upset about the $20,000, $30,000 or whatever that you'd be able to sell that for. So obviously the, you know, physical things, as you had mentioned, when there's a rarity to it, or when there's something that can deteriorate, so there's a scarcity to it, there's a timeline that it'll exist for, it's going to have a higher value. So when we go to digital goods, obviously the value of those things is going to diminish the more easy it is to copy. But, you know, with the freely, not freely available, but the ever expanding capacity of hard drives and things, why should anybody throw things away aside from the ease of being able to go through it? Isn't there the possibility that that might, you might lose some value in there that you might not perceive yourself, that somebody else could find value in?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's some fun science fiction stories about, and I'm going to mangle this, but about, you know, everyone dies on Earth and people come and find our stuff and they get so excited they've been able to reconstruct a video and they're going to, or a film, and they're going to watch it. And, you know, they now understand what human life on Earth was like. And then the end of the story was like, you know, if only they understood what, you know, a Disney production meant. So you could say something, and I think what we would toss has huge value to sociologists and to other people. You could also toss stuff that could be tremendously valuable later in your life. So I'm not saying you should wholesale wipe your hard drive, but I think, you know, organization is critical. Prioritization is important. I mean, there are definitely financial information and financial data. Passwords, websites, content is important. Thinking about who needs to control it is important. So, you know, there are things that I would tell you, Jeff, you should definitely appoint me to take care of some aspects of your estate, but I wouldn't know what to do with your Facebook posts. But other people would be really good at saying, this is important, this should be kept, this shouldn't be. I think the method in which you archive assets is important. You know, I was in the garage looking for something and came on a box of, you know, one of those boxes with thousands of cords and lots of plastic implements in it. And in there were a whole bunch of the iOmega drives from sort of the early 90s. And I just was looking at them thinking, I don't even know that I have a peripheral that would access what's on these, much less a computer that would read the peripheral, and I could probably go to a store that would access it. You know, is the data even intact? And do I care about the data? And I think so that's, you know, important. I have a whole box of thumb drives, and I routinely go through and wipe everything or move everything off because I'm always terrified I'm going to leave something important on the thumb drive. But you think about the places that you store data and the types of things that you store. I'm not saying you have to get rid of it, but at least make sure you know where things are. And if, you know, your journals or your old web posts are out there, get them into a space where someone could use them. Mm-hmm. There was a fabulous book that was published earlier this year called The Opposite of Loneliness. It was just wonderful because of the voice. It was written by a published posthumously of a Yale graduate, class of 2013, who was killed a couple weeks after her graduation. And she was a writer, and her parents collected her essays and published them. And the voice is so beautiful, and she wrote just like a 20-year-old would write 21-year-old. So it was wonderful to read for that. But I thought I wondered how much of her stuff no one was able to find because it was in a, you know, online app or something where she might have written stuff down versus, you know, the published pieces or the journals, the hard assets that they were able to find things from.
Yeah, like the notes, the random thoughts that might have made it into something else that if they were, you know, interspersed between chapters might have added context or something.
Or just been interesting to look at. I mean, we tracked so much of what, you know, artists have done. You know, here's an early version of his work on this. Here's another version. I went through an exhibit at the Met several years ago where there were these clay models that Bernini did for his big statues. And it was fascinating to watch, like, what the artist did. You know, if you are playing around with digital photography, but the final image is only what's kept, you're losing something in that art transition. And I think in human lives, so much of the value and the richness that we have is that path that we take. You know, the journals that you kept when you were a teenager can be tremendously valuable to look back on. Well, if it was all on MySpace, because that's where you were posting, you know, you're out of luck, or on whatever channel you were on when you were 15 or 20. And I'm really bothered by this whole Google forget me, that I could wipe out my history. I understand why Google does it, and believe me, I think there's some things all of us would like to wipe out of our lives. But the idea that you could somehow erase all traces of something is actually kind of dangerous if you think about it in a broad societal context. But fundamentally, you know, talking about death, talking about your ending is tough and daunting, and getting organized and organizing. I mean, I have a hard enough time organizing my desk, much less organizing everything else. And yet it's such a critical issue to talk about. And again, the conflict here is really that we're putting so much content together and so much out there and so much of our lives is online, and yet our laws just haven't kept up with it. We don't have the ability to access. I can't access your password unless you leave me authorization, and most people don't have the right documents in place to create the authorization to let me onto your sites, much less a list of the 20 sites I'd need to get on.
And then on top of that, each of those sites have a different terms of service about what is and is not allowed, and there's really no standardization across that.
Absolutely. So,
and they're changing constantly.
Oh, they're constantly changing. You don't have an ability to opt out. And, you know, we found a box of albums the other day, and it was kind of surreal to look at all these albums from college, you know, in the late 80s, and kind of odd because we really stopped buying albums a few years before that. So there was a huge amount of music that was very important to me that I never owned on an album. And yet it's there, but looking back at iTunes, the different trends that you've had of when you bought certain things and when you didn't can be really interesting just as a retrospective of your life. And yet that's the terms of service. It's a single user license. I have a license to listen to it, but I don't own the music. I can't gift you my iTunes account when I die, which upsets the capitalist in me tremendously, because my view is if I paid for it, I should be able to do something with it.
Yeah, no, I can completely appreciate that. And I think that all of these shifts, I mean, they're so fundamental, from something that is uncopyable in its original form to something that is easily copyable hundreds of thousands of millions of times over infinitely. And then there's the question of whether or not these are actually permanent. You know, we talk about things that are not digital as if they're, you know, eventually doomed to deteriorate and fall away in their original form. And we talk about digital as if it's there forever. But to your point with, you know, being able to wipe something from the internet, as Google now is, you know, compelled to do by some areas of Europe. And then also your example of the zip drive or the jazz drive, that just because something's digital doesn't mean it'll survive the transition from one format to the next. But here's a question I wanted to ask you as you were talking about cleaning up your digital life, and you had mentioned artists and their kind of original works and sketch pads and things like that. Do you think that in this heavily contented, noisy world that we're beginning to move into, that diminishing the amount of content, that by actively reducing it, you can increase the value of any of your other content? So as an example, you know, Seth Godin only writes on his blog. He doesn't have like a Facebook page. I mean, it auto posts to a Facebook page. He doesn't use Twitter. He just writes on his blog and he writes his books. Do you think that if he were to have hundreds of other sites and be populating all that, that it would diminish the value of the one property. And in the same way, do you think that if someone like Kim Kardashian, who has thousands upon hundreds of thousands of tweets, versus someone who very, very carefully selects to post 20 tweets over the course of their life, do you think that those are things that affect value in a digital ecosystem?
I think you could argue both ways. I mean, I think that the value, what's the value of a single Kim Kardashian tweet?
$10,000, actually. I just learned this. It's actually $10,000. You can get Kim Kardashian to tweet anything for you.
Well, which is interesting because that's a value someone has put on the following that she has. But if she dies, no one's going to take on her following. Like, no one's going to want to pay to tweet as Kim Kardashian, although maybe, you know, someone will, and they'll hide that she died 20 years ago. It'll be a great conspiracy story.
That would be an interesting one.
It's a really good idea for a screenplay, but I think it's sort of akin to some of the other movies that have been made over the last couple of years. But, you know, versus a more serious writer, I think there is a value to having, you know, sort of one area. But think about it. If you then found an unscripted part of Seth Godin's views, if you found, you know, neo-Nazi views that he was espousing under a pen name somewhere else, would that have value? Probably tremendous value, tremendous interest to somebody if he was found to have that. I mean, J.K. Rowling published some book under the name, you know, pseudonym, because she was trying to think, she knew that she wouldn't get good reviews or honest reviews if it came out in her name. And then once it had great success, she admitted to having it. So I think, you know, it's an interesting argument to make, you know, should you be very discreet in what you are tweeting and very thoughtful? Are you out there with everything that's, you know, it goes to branding, it goes to presence. But what you might put out on your Facebook page for me to read might be very different than what you would say in email to me.
Yes. Actually, you know what? That brings up a whole nother point. With these various different hurdles of privacy, are there not then multiple different collections? So when, after somebody dies, and let's say you have a series of posts on your Facebook that can only be published to your close friends, when those become then opened, can they become open then to the rest of the world? And does it then take on increased value because they're more scarce? It was for a smaller audience. So I think, you know, all of these things are really, really interesting because it kind of leads to, you know, is there going to eventually be a need for someone like a digital death curator? So somebody who actually actively manages the value of your, you know, after you've passed on, actively manages your digital assets to curate the best thing for the highest value. Is that something that could be out
and
there?
I think there is. I mean, my nephew is a very good photographer and travels a lot and posts on his Facebook page, and I'm named as his executor, and I've joked with him that I could actually make a lot of money, and I've encouraged him to post his pictures to the stock photography sites because I think people would buy them. So is there a value? Do I have an obligation as his executor to monetize those assets? Do I have to actually get on my son's Steam thing and figure out how to sell the Sword of Torak? I have no idea. Or is there an opportunity for people to come in and essentially buy up those sites? You know, do I want to go buy my college roommate's farmland? If we're judging on the amount of emails I get and updates about what she's done on it, there's got to be a lot of value there. And it all comes, you know, it's completely foreign to many people that you would put real money to buy ephemeral goods. They don't understand that you would actually pay to buy a pig on farmland with dollars that are deducted from your PayPal account. And yet those same people think nothing of buying a book on iTunes.
That's actually the first time I've ever heard it phrased that way, because as you're talking about buying a pig on Farmville with real money, all it goes to my head is that's ridiculous. And then you said buy a book, and I was like, well, that makes sense. But it's just, that's very interesting because maybe it's because of exactly when I grew up, one of the first times I think I've ever felt old. Thanks, Holly.
Welcome to my world.
Right? I look at a lot of these games that sell the virtual goods or the upgrades or things like that, and I think, why would I pay for that? Shouldn't I be playing the game to earn that or whatever? And I just look at a lot of these virtual good services where you're buying people – you know, things that exist only in cyberspace, and they just don't make sense to me. But you've given it kind of a tangible one, which is books and music and a lot of media. So you've definitely kind of changed my world on that a bit. But that kind of leads me into the question of, you know, let's look at what's happening right now in, if we look at the movement in the collaborative economy, where we're no longer owning things so much as we're sharing things. And we're looking at a world where there's more of an access than there is a push towards ownership. So music, you look at services like RDO and Spotify, where you don't actually own any music. You just have access to it. You can create your own playlist. But the minute you stop playing, that's no longer your music to listen to, or at least not ad free. You know, you look at that versus an iTunes model, which was the one that came prior to that, where you did sort of own the music, but it was single user. And then before that, CDs, and before that, tapes, and then record collections. As we go up that that chain of, I guess, progress, I'm putting it in air quotes, the value of each of those mediums that carry the information diminishes. And now we're at the point where music has virtually no value. It's $9.99 a month for unlimited access. How does that actually shift in your mind? If you look out from here moving forward, how is this going to impact a number of different industries as far as the value of things that we have? And doesn't that ultimately shift what our entire economy looks like if we no longer have ownership over things in our when we're alive, let alone when we're dead? How do we place value on things when there's no value when we're alive?
Well, I also think you're going to see a huge shift. I think, you know, why would I pay? Shouldn't I just buy the stock in the company? Because that's how I monetize the value in Spotify or something like that. At the same time, and that's a tangible asset that can pass under my estate, and my lawyer is going to look at that, or my executor, and just check the box. But, you know, think about iTunes and the value that's created when you make a playlist or a remix. You know, when you remix a song, and there are people that have their entire careers remixing, you know, songs or merging songs of two different artists together to create new sounds. You know, there's value in that. And I think, too, we have to step back and say, what's the economic value versus what's the social or sentimental value? Because you're right, there's no economic value if I have a subscription other than you've got to make sure your executor knows how to shut down that subscription or you're going to keep getting charged in perpetuity. And there are all sorts of horror stories that you can talk about where, you know, nobody paid attention to the fact that PayPal was debiting directly from your bank account or running up on a credit card and someone ran off with your PayPal account, or you kept piling up subscriptions and renewals on a decedent's account. But, you know, apart from that economic value, you're creating content. The fact that you listen to that might be really meaningful to me as a friend or, you know, a spouse. And I want to have access to the things that meant something to you. And I think overlying it, again, from my sort of death perspective as an estate person, is we ask people to make decisions at the time that they are least capable of making decisions. And so to the extent that you can get organized and help me as a loved one know what to keep or what might be important to you is going to be so much more valuable than if I just shut down all of your accounts once you die because I'm in a hurry to clean things up. I really might want to come back and find comfort in listening to the playlist that you liked or the stations that you liked or remembering the music or sharing that with family members. And I think, you know, we haven't even touched on it. I know we're running close on time, is, you know, the whole rise of digital mourning. I mean, you, from a sociological perspective, it's fascinating that I can get on people's web pages and study how they communicate with people, because it's kind of awkward to lurk in graveyards trying to eavesdrop on people talking to graves on visiting days and stuff. But how people think about their post-mortem presence. Yahoo has this ending service in Japan, which I always love because, you know, some things out of Japan are really cool. But it's neat. It's saying, like, how are you going to, you know, shut down? And it's got, like, a password keeper, and you can put stuff in there. What I got a kick out of was it basically is going to send my kids a text message saying, okay, I'm dead, so here's the password to unlock. And I thought, I don't know that I want my kids to find out it's like, I'm dead.
Not via text. That seems impersonal.
That just seems, it seems kind of cold. But, you know, it is, I think that the way people mourn online is really going to be more and more important because, you know, you share everything on your Twitter or your Facebook or your other social media. That's how people come together. I had a friend whose father died very suddenly, and we realized that no one was going to read the obituary in the local papers, so they had to pull together email lists and how to contact people. And that's for an older person. I mean, half of your email contacts in your phone, if I get access to your phone, might be people that care. They might be someone you met at a conference that doesn't know who you are, but it might be that much more important if I post it on your Twitter feed. And is that how you want someone to find out? I mean, we could go on and on. It's fascinating.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, I have a couple more questions I want to ask you. I know that we're running close to our time, but I just have to ask you a couple of these things. So on the topic of mourning, who gets to say how long you get to have a digital afterlife? And is there some responsibility on the part of sites like Facebook or Twitter to keep it up either indefinitely or to set some sort of a time limit? And when you think about how many spam accounts and dead and, you know, dead figuratively speaking, like unused accounts there are on Facebook and Twitter, if there was someone who is particularly active or has chosen that they want to keep this open, Does a site like Facebook or Twitter have a responsibility to kind of keep that open as a place for people to mourn? You know, one of the things I thought of when I was thinking about that particular, the digital mourning aspect is how many people visit Jim Morrison's grave in France every year, every day. And imagine if that was a Facebook page. Imagine if right now, you know, some epic rocker were to pass away and that was where the legacy was not just the physical grave, but also the digital grave where people could go and actually talk about their favorite songs and all those things. What do you think the responsibility is and who gets to say how long somebody has a digital afterlife?
Well, it really is so dependent on terms of service contracts, but I think the biggest challenge there is, you know, once you notify Facebook that it becomes an in memoriam page, it gets frozen. Some aspects of the site get shut down. People can post information to the site. You need to appoint a digital executor who has power to keep it up or shut it down, and that person should have it. I think, you know, but the other challenge is how Facebook morphs over time with its ads and the fact that it's, you know, I don't want to be getting emails that you like New Balance sneakers because somebody on your site posted it or somehow Facebook is changing how they use the data. So there really isn't a limit. But on the other hand, if I don't access your Gmail accounts, or other email accounts, they'll go away. And maybe there's really important information there. There's also, you don't own all the accounts. You know, there are email chains that I wish I had access to. So I was working at Goldman Sachs during 9/11. And I really wish I had the email exchanges from that day as I was trying to find out where my team was and as I was emailing my husband that I was still alive because I was supposed to be on the flight that ended up in the tower and didn't go to L.A. that day. And he thought I was on the shuttle from Boston and I was in a rental car, you know. So those are things that, you know, but they're corporate emails. I don't have access to those. I don't have a right to claim those. When I worked for Lehman Brothers and they went bankrupt, you know, I don't have any of my records from them. So, you know, who has the rights to my Facebook and my Twitter account? I've got to have a digital executor named in my documents, and somebody can keep track of the feeds and stay on top of it. So it's not going to be my parents, and it's probably not going to be my husband. And those are the defaults under most estate plans.
Mm-hmm. So, it's a good answer. the final question I have, I just want to touch on this one really quickly, but the When I was researching digital death prior to this, I was just kind of looking around and seeing what was out there. And there are some celebrities that were doing sort of a voluntary digital death to raise money for – it was for AIDS in Africa, and they were trying to raise money for that. They basically shut down all of their online activity and said they won't come back until a certain amount of money had been raised for this charity, which I thought was very, very cool. But it brought up for me the idea of sort of a pre-death digital death as an exercise in helping people get a sense of what they would do, what should be done in the event of. Do you think that that's something that should start to become more and more part of estate planning, more part of financial advising, and kind
of... Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Where do you see it going?
I do a lot of it with clients anyway, of just, okay, if you died, let's go through who gets what, let's go through what happens. It's a great exercise because inevitably people forget, and at the first pass, it's usually, who do I call? What do I have? You know, what documents do they need to see so that people have a sense of what to do? And again, you know, if your loved one has just died, if your husband or your wife has just died, you're not really in the point to think, I need 11 copies of the death certificate. The second is just, you know, okay, what are the conflicts that my business partners are going to want to have? What are those issues? And then, you know, the second or third iteration we often do get around to, where is the information? Where are your passwords kept? What sites do we need to go to? What should we keep up? What should we not? And I think what's frustrated me is that most of what I have seen in the space is very dated. It's no different than what, you know, my grandmother had in 1985 when I was working on her estate as a, you know, high school, college student of, I really wasn't into it back then, so it's not like I was some weird child prodigy or whatever, but, you know, which was a list that her broker had given her and her attorney had given her of just listing out on paper. And paper is not what you need for this. You need URLs, you need an H, you know, something that's vibrant and something that's going to stay updated, because mm-hmm. it doesn't help me that I have your Smith Barney broker number, because that firm hasn't existed in years. So I think these digital audits or digital, you know, death audits or, you know, pre-death planning exercises are something everyone should do. I think if you just ask yourself the question I led off with, if you had died last night, what would have happened today, is important. Because once you get people into it, we start to come up with, where are you, you know, what do you want done? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want to be buried at sea? Can you even be buried at sea? Do you want to, how much money do you want to spend on this? What issues do we need? What information do we need? And it leads into a huge planning process and is a very, I think, a very healthy exercise for people to go through, just because it brings up things that you will savor in lifetime, saying, you know what, I have to make sure Jeff knows about that.
Yeah. I want to be digitized. Is that possible yet?
I had a client that wanted to be digitized. He also wanted to be frozen. That's for beers sometime. yeah, there are definitely people that want to be digitized. I just remind them that Microsoft DOS was pretty wonky, and, you know, I get the blue screen every now and then. So may not work, but you never know. It could be. That would save a lot of issues. But then who gets to decide what version of you gets digitized? I want to come back looking, I want to be 5'10".
Oh, that's fascinating. Holly, you are so much fun to talk to. Not obviously now I know not just over drinks or, you know, for interesting conversation out and about in real life, but also on a podcast. So thank you so much
for coming on and
talking about digital death with us. I think it's such an interesting conversation, and we'll obviously have so much more to talk about with this. So thanks for coming on.
I would love to continue it. Thanks so much. Take care.
Awesome. Wait, before you go, though, one last thing. Where can people go to find out more about you and to be social with you?
They can get me on Twitter at Holly Isdale. They can find me at digitaldeath.com, which hopefully is up and running. If not, my last name, isdale@mac.com, is always an easy one to use.
Excellent. And we'll put those all in the show notes so people can look into what you're doing and connect with you more. And we're going to be working on that TED talk, you and I. We got to get you on TED. And for those out there listening, let the TED people know that we need to talk.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed that episode of Conversations. Be sure to go over to iTunes or Stitcher and give us a rating. Tell us what you love about the show, what you hate about the show. And we hope you come back for our next episode. Take care.